Okay, good afternoon. So let's see, I am sharing my web page right now, and what I added to the top was the secretary was able to put together as far as passing scores. Apparently the information exists, but it's not really been compiled anywhere. But in any case, this is the last few, so it gives one some idea of what is required to pass. And it yeah, so basically if you do four of them well, then you're in good shape usually. But it does vary by exam. Okay, let's see. My thoughts for today, we could talk about writing up some of the problems that we have already seen, or we could proceed. What I put together today were a collection of problems that were of various types. So some of them are just kind of odd ones that don't really fit in any particular genre, and others are just examples of the things that we've done previously. So we could just look at some of those also, and then at that point we could, I guess, decide whether to just figure out again, as we have been, the basic outline of how it would be done, or to try to figure out a bit more about how one might write up some of them. Let's see, I guess I can do my usual thing of just kind of running briefly through the ones we did yesterday as a review in case anyone has any comments or has worked out something. And actually, I guess before I start, has anyone written up anything last night that they wanted to mention? Okay, then let me just do as I have before and just take a quick look at the ones that we looked at yesterday, just as a summary. And please stop me and make comments if you've had some other thoughts about them since what we said before, or have questions. All right, so let's see. There we go. Right, so this one was an interesting one in that there were various ways to think about it. You could do it in a rather hands-on way, or you could think about it a bit more abstractly, and both of them had their merits, and I think we sort of did both. So I think we looked at this one in some detail already. Let's see. This we used as a opportunity to look at projectives and free, and again, this is a good one just to have up your sleeve for various counterexamples. The rings that are products behave differently from rings like polynomial rings and the integers, so they're good ones occasionally. Let's see. Question is not a PID. Which is a PID but not a field. Yep, so we did that one, and that's the sort of thing that you should, if you spot something like that, you should do it quickly because that's an easy one. Okay. Let's see. This one we did in some detail. I don't know, did anyone have any further thoughts about that one? So this one I kind of sketched how you might do the extended Euclidean algorithm. Did anyone actually try it to see if it made sense? So I think I sketched enough about it that one could do it, but I didn't really write it up cleanly. Okay. And let's see. So this one. Yeah, so this is another example of doing the classification theorem. Okay, this one we talked about at some length, and it illustrated the fact that the classification theorem is powerful, but the actual construction of the isomorphism itself is sometimes tricky and a little bit subtle. This one, I think, is where we left off. Right, so we were in the midst of doing this one. Let's see, so maybe we should finish this one up, and then we can, we didn't look at the other two, I don't believe, so there's no need to now, and then go to the usual picture of a new exam and whatnot. Okay, so I think we were in the midst of looking at this one. So does anyone have any further thoughts about this? Maybe we could just sort of summarize where we were in my memory, and you can tell me if I've missed something that you recall. So as I recall, we had considered the various ideals that are present here. So there's the whole ring itself, which is one of the trivial ones, and then the ideal I plus J, and then there are the two ideals I and J themselves. Okay, and then there's the intersection. And then there's the product. And this being a principal ideal domain, we had names for the generators. And I have forgotten what they are, so I'm going to get new names, I guess. So let me call this one A. Okay, and since I and J are contained in there, this one is equal to A times something. And this, yes? I'm happy to switch to the names I was using before if that's more convenient and someone remembers them. AY, and then the product was just the product of those two things, so A squared XY. Okay, and this is also principal, of course, because they all are, and I don't know that we'd figured out a name for the generator for that yet. So I think that's about where we were. All right, so did anyone have any more thoughts about how to show this? So the question is to show that, that these are the same, if and only if these are the same.
I sort of know what direction.
Okay.
So if I plus J is R, then as someone said yesterday, I is in I plus J. Sorry, 1 is in I plus J. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And so 1 can be written as AY plus BX for some, so sorry, like what's the notation?
Let's use Greeks, how about, because I've used up all those letters. Okay, yeah, so okay, so alpha
I plus
I, okay, and now I am writing as AY,
okay,
plus beta AX, okay, yep.
Okay, and if we take any, yeah, and now we right now we want to show that I intersect J is in IJ, because one direction of inclusion is already
correct. So
yeah,
this is that direction. Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So take any element in I intersect J. We want to show that it's in I times J.
Okay.
And if I denote this element by K, then K is equal to 1 times K, which is alpha AY plus beta AX times K.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And I just distributed, yep.
Okay, yes, sure. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the first alpha AY K is in the form of something in I times something in J, because K is in I intersect J, so K is in J.
Okay.
Yes, and so and the second sum is also in I times J by the same reasoning.
Oh, right. Yeah. K is in I this time, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're good. So this is in IJ. Okay. And that's it, right? So you've proven one direction.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. And that's a nice clean write-up. Okay, and did anyone have thoughts about the other direction? So now we're going to assume that that so we need if I intersect J is equal to IJ, then R is equal to I plus J. Okay, let's see. So what about the element AXY? Is that one helpful to us? Right, remember, this is a principal ideal domain, so every one of our ideals is generated by some element. And since I plus j here contains I, we know that the generator for I is a multiple of the generator for I plus j, and similarly for j. And so we can choose these elements as written over here, A, X, and Y, and then we could consider the element A, X, Y. So can we use that one helpful for anything?
It's always in the intersection.
Mm-hmm. That's a good start, right? So this is going to be in I, and it's also in J. And of course, since we're assuming that I intersect J is equal to IJ, then that means it's also in the product. And if, since, by assumption, I intersect J is equal to IJ, we also have that it's in the product.
So we can write AXY equals to R times A square XY.
Exactly.
And then using that we are in a domain. Mm-hmm. So that could imply that A is a unit. I don't see.
All right, go off the board. Okay, yeah, exactly. That's right. So that R is going to be our inverse, right, for the A.
Yeah.
Pretty good. I'm not sure what's visible and what's not. Anyway. Okay.
Sorry. What is R?
Oh yeah. So hence, there exists some R for which. Can you see this? Can people see what I'm writing way down at the bottom here, or should I start over somewhere else? Visible? So what I've written down here is that AXY is equal to R times A squared XY, and that's because AXY is in this ideal IJ, and a generator for this ideal is A squared XY. So R is just whatever element happens to have that effect, happens to do that, because we know it, there has to be one, okay? Right, and so that's R. And then since it's a domain, we can cancel and we get one equals RA. Okay, and that's a reasonably clean write-up of this one, except that, you know, you add a few words, I guess.
Would we need to address the possibility that A or X or Y is zero? Separately?
Let's see.
Because I think the therefore one equals RA depends on it all does. Three of those not being zero.
You're right, it does. I guess, let's see, so what happened to the zero case? So, Yeah, I'm tempted to just say to treat them separately, but I'm just trying to see why.
They can't both be zero, right? And their statements aren't true.
Well, I mean, if they're both zero, then this is the zero ideal, and this is the zero ideal. This is the zero ideal.
But then the sum can't equal the whole ring, right?
Oh, that's true.
Unless the whole ring is it's the zero ring. But it's not necessarily the zero ring, so we're in trouble, I think.
Yeah, so you have, I see. So you have to check the zero for all three of those, I, J, and R, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, like, the converse doesn't hold if one of them is zero, I guess, so we should ask at the beginning that.
You're right.
The others are not zero, probably.
You're right. Okay, yeah, so that's a good point to make. So you need the non-zero. Yep, so you're right. You should certainly non-zero. You should certainly consider the zero case separately and make comment about what goes wrong there. Yes. Which we missed before, right? Thanks. Okay, any other comments or thoughts about this one? Okay, and let's see. So then I guess what I was thinking was to do the usual going to an exam, and then I have collected some sort of, as I said, various problems. So some of them are uncategorizable and some of them are previous examples. Okay, so let's just go to this old exam. And as usual, once you have some thoughts or some comment, either somehow signal that you're ready to start looking at them.
Number two, the word embeds, does that mean there's some injective homomorphism from G into GL and Z?
That is how I would interpret it, yes.
Okay.
You
if we can show that geo NZ is a subgroup of SN, then that solves it too.
Other way around, right? But yes. Mm-hmm. So you want to do this, right? Like that?
Oh, I guess I was trying to think of like every GLNRZ, there's a bijection between those and subgroups of SN, but that's probably not true.
Well, see, the first thing that comes to mind is that this target group is infinite, and this one is finite.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
But for the whatever the name of the theorem is, I think it's Cauchy's theorem, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Cauchy, yeah.
Yeah, the G embeds into SN, and then wouldn't the other embedding be like mapping to a permutation matrix?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. So that would be most definitely be a good approach to doing that one. Yeah. So in that setting, you're taking N to be equal to the order of the group, right?
Yes.
Okay, are people about ready to come up with ideas for the other five? Okay, but another 30 seconds, then we'll just discuss through the other five. Okay, all right. So let's see. So I guess maybe this time we should try seeing. So that one we figured out. Does anyone have a suggestion for what the next easiest one might be that we should contemplate next?
Number four.
All right. Yeah, that looks similar to stuff we've done before. All right, and what's an answer to this one?
The ideal generated by 2 and x.
Mm-hmm. Right. And is that one prime? So that one's not principal, right?
The ideal generated by x squared is not prime, I think.
Sounds right.
Prime ideal is every element in the ideal is
you don't want to give a definition?
I think, and I could be wrong, that I is prime if A, B in I implies A in I or B in I.
Yeah, I think that's...
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right.
That's a definition. But then there's also a useful characterization of quotients by primes. You remember that? So so remember there's this whole dictionary. So maximals are give you fields.
I think primes give you domains.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if we take the quotient by this x squared, is it clear that that fails to be a domain? That's one easy way to see it. That's one way. I mean, something other way, but.
So what do you mean by a domain?
Integral domain.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah. Zero divisors.
Yeah, because x is a zero divisor.
Exactly right. So x is non-zero, but of course x squared is an ideal, so x squared is zero. It's basically the same argument as why it's prime. Or not prime, rather. Okay, very good. Right, exactly. So that one's quick. Yeah, you just write those down and you're pretty much done. All right, next. What would people try next?
Sorry, can we real quick just do the proof that the ideal generated by 2 and x is not principal?
Principal? Okay, yeah, right. So so can anyone see that one?
This is one of those ones that I have the counterexample memorized, but not the proof. Why?
Okay. Right. So, I mean, there are various ways that you could approach this. One is just to assume that there were a generator and get a contradiction, right? So if you had P of X were a generator, then you'd have A of X times P of X equals 2 and B of X times P of X equals X. Right. And this is a very, R is a nice ring because it has this concept of degree, which is additive.
So the first line tells us that P of X has to be degree 1?
Degree 0, yeah.
Degree 0.
Right.
But then that's where you get the contradiction in the second one because
right.
Degree down here.
Well, so that tells you that P of X has degree 0, so P of X is equal to some number, P naught. Right. And since some number times it is equal to 2, P naught is equal to either 1 or 2, right, because it has to divide 2. Uh, And if it's equal to 1, then you're getting the whole ring. And if it's equal to 2, then it doesn't divide x. Okay, so all that remains is to show that 2 comma x is not the whole ring. And to do that, it's enough to show that a of x times 2 plus b of x times x is never equal to 1. And again, you can use degree arguments, right? This one has degree at least 1. And so this one has to have the same degree as over here. So this is going to have to be 0. And so the one on the left has to be some constant. And 2 is not invertible in the integers. Yeah, so you basically just run through it like that. Does that make sense? Just kind of by hand.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So I believe that deals with 2 and 4, right? All right, so then what would be the next one that people might attempt?
Five, maybe.
Okay. Okay, did people have some idea how to approach that? Right, so can you just write down the inverse?
Sorry, excuse me. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing something like x to the power of n minus 1 minus x to the power of n minus 2 plus mm-hmm. x to the power of... So we need the x to the power of n to cancel out and...
That sounds right. Okay, so you're going to just start writing the powers and yeah. with alternating sign? Mm-hmm. And then just multiply and check that it's an inverse. Okay, and why didn't that work if x were not nilpotent?
You could go on forever on that polynomial inverse.
That's right, and we don't, and that's not going to be an element of our ring typically. I mean, it may or may not be, but there's no reason that an infinite sum should be an element of our ring. Exactly. Okay, very good. And so what about... okay, what's next? So that's half of them. So pretty close to a passing score already.
I sort of have an idea for number one, but I'm not sure how to make it like super nicely written.
Okay, so the idea here be?
So because our generators are finite, we can put some order onto them, A, B, C, so on.
Okay.
And then we can just start writing out what all the possible elements of G are. Some of them might be duplicates, but that's okay.
Okay. Just by taking words in these things, you mean?
Yeah, by taking words. And there's going to be some... lexicographical order on these words that you can count. First word, second word, third word.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So finite words, I guess. So finite words in this are countable. Okay.
So, like I said, some of these might be duplicates as elements of G.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay because we can find some subsequence.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
Skips the duplicates.
Okay. We can just take the first time we see any particular element, for example. Is that what you're saying? So,
right.
You got a list. You can wait.
So but I guess the point is that...
If you've seen it before, just throw it out. So,
Yeah, but I guess the point is that a subset of a countable set is countable.
That's right. That sounds right. So, and a subset of a countable set is countable. Yeah, that seems like it would do it. Does anyone else have another way to phrase it or to approach this?
I don't think this helps, but they can be phrased as free groups, but it doesn't really change the meaning of the proof.
I kind of agree. I mean, I'm also very tempted to phrase it as a quotient of a free group. But I think you're right that the proof stays about the same. But still, I agree that that's how I would like to phrase it. So note that G is Fn mod something, a quotient of a finitely generated free group. And then you amount to showing that the free group is countable and that quotient sets of countable sets are again countable. Right. Very similar. Okay, any other thoughts about number one? All right, let's see. So what's up? So I guess we still haven't looked at three or six. Does anyone have ideas for either of those?
I think six doesn't require anything substantial, but it's just keeping track of the definitions and the little lemmas about extensions. I'm pretty sure so I think one fact is the finite extensions are algebraic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the fundamental theorem of algebra probably has a real root or something. And then, it's probably also you can't get bigger than the algebraic closure, which is C.
Right.
So I think those three together probably get you there.
I think you're right too. Yeah, it makes sense basically just to review your basic lemmas about extensions. And then, as you say, I think that one will be straightforward to write out, basically using the what you just mentioned. Yeah. And this one is certainly a good thing to know. And it doesn't hurt even to be able to prove it because the proof's kind of short, and a technique that sometimes comes up. It's again this idea of take powers and wait until they're linearly dependent. Okay, so that's kind of how six goes. So that just leaves three. So any thoughts about three?
Sorry, I didn't really follow what just happened for number six.
Ah, okay. So if I understood correctly, so one can use the fact that finite extensions are algebraic, okay? So if we're trying to get a finite extension field of R, it's got to be some algebraic extension, all right? And
algebraic extension is every element of F is a root of some polynomial in R?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. Another way to say it, since it's finite, is that you can get it by extending one element at a time, each of which is a polynomial. So you can build it by taking a quotient by one polynomial and then doing it again a finite number of times. That's equivalent. Right. That's a finite algebraic extension. There are algebraic extensions that are not finite extensions, right? But these are finite extensions we're looking at, and so if it's finite, you can always build it in this way, and in that way you're demonstrating that it's algebraic. Okay, Anyway, yeah, so they are algebraic, and that's the definition. And since it's a, so then the claim is that with the fundamental theorem of algebra, that any polynomial of degree higher than 2 is going to have a real root, and so it'll be decomposable over, I'm sorry, not a real root, but it will be decomposable over R. So it won't be irreducible. So if we want to do a single extension, the best we can do is a quadratic. So we'll get something of degree 2. And then again, the fundamental theorem of algebra tells us that C has no algebraic extensions because every polynomial factors into linear terms. So then we'll be done. So I believe that was the gist of the argument that was being outlined.
I am curious about something. So there's a extension called Hamilton, or what, like the IJK thingy? The, sorry, it's like a...
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's a skew field. Right, so so that's not a field though, right? The H? Yeah, that's certainly an interesting object and certainly something to consider. But you mean the following thing. Don't like this board much, but yeah, let me see here. Let me just switch boards so that it's clear. So you mean the following thing, which is an object that comes up a lot, so it's a good one to keep in mind, but it's not commutative, right?
Sorry, we still can't see the fourth right
now. I know, I'm still working on it, but soon it'll be there. There we go. All right. So it's not commutative, right? So the thing, if I understand right, that you're talking about is you're going to take R and you're going to join I, J, and K. And then you're going to have relations like I squared equals J squared equals K squared equals minus 1. That's all well and good. But then you're going to have relations like I, J is equal to K. But ji is equal to minus k, right?
Okay.
Is that the thing you're talking about? This is the...
Yes. Sorry.
Goes by this name, right? Quaternions. So, yeah, so this is the quaternions, and it's not commutative. So this is a skew field, which in particular means not a field.
Okay. Thank you.
Because it's not commutative. Anyway, it comes up a lot. It's certainly an interesting object and was something to keep in mind properties of, but it's not relevant to this particular problem. Okay?
Okay.
Right. All right. Oops. So, back. So, okay, so then, any other questions about that one? Okay, so that just leaves this upper triangular matrices one. So is that one going to be tricky? I think we even talked about it earlier, yeah?
Yeah, I remember that the goal is that at each step you're constructing, like you're zeroing out another diagonal until eventually you just have like one lonely element up in the upper right corner, and then the next step after that is the zero matrix. But I don't remember how you take each step.
Yeah. Okay. So the series that you can use for solvability is to take G and take its commutator, and then take G and take its commutator with that, and then take G and take its commutator with that. So that's the that's one way to get a central series that whose finiteness detects solvability, and in particular, it'll do exactly what you just described.
Sorry, could you repeat that thing about zeroing out more diagonal things? I think I'm confused and don't understand what you mean.
Okay, maybe. So let's see. So
in particular, because this is all the diagonal entries have to be non-zero. So
I'm... You're right. I'm sorry. No. I'm sorry. I'm talking about the case where they're all ones and where this is nilpotent. I apologize. So this is the series for nilpotent, not for solvable. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
For solvable,
okay.
You want to take the commutator and then the commutator with the results, not with the original group. Like that. Right. Yeah, so for solvable, what do you need? So you have to take a sequence of normal subgroups so that the quotients are abelian, right? That's what you need, and so let's just try it. So, and it's exactly as you described. So let's take the upper triangular ones. So let's give a name. So let's say that if our matrices are, say, ones on the diagonal and then zeros, up until level I, and this is an M by M matrix. Let's call this GIN, okay? So then G0N is the thing we're interested in, and we want to find a subgroup, right? So if we take a G0N and we want to find a normal subgroup of that, I claim that G1N is such a thing. Right, so this is so G1N, does that make sense? So these are the matrices that are ones on the diagonal. Let me be more precise. So let me just do a simple example. So let's take N equals 3. So then we have our original group, looks like this. And contained in it is the group which is ones on the diagonal. Okay. This is a normal subgroup, and the quotient group is diagonal, which is abelian. Okay, is that does that make sense? Should I put in more words, or is it clear what I mean there?
Is there any intuitive way to think about solvable groups?
They're subgroups of this group. They're groups that you can pull apart into a sequence of abelian groups, like this one.
Okay.
So there's groups that have a normal subgroup, which quotient is abelian, then another abelian, and then another extension, so it's a sequence. Where in each case the quotient is abelian. And that's exactly, in fact, this is exactly the right example to think of always. All right, so is it clear what I'm saying or not? So definition.
Yes.
So people understand what GIK is, or KN? So it's susceptible N by N matrices. Do we have a field here? Doesn't say. Okay, let me take a C, N by N, such that G I J is equal to zero if I is bigger than j, and not equal to zero if I is equal to j. Okay, and also if k is equal to bigger than zero, then Gij is equal to one, and Gij, II is equal to one, and Gij is equal to zero if I is greater than J minus K. Okay, so it's exactly what I've written up here. It's going to be ones along the diagonal, then some zeros, and then some arbitrary. Okay, and then you just compute that this is a right. So this is the set of all things of the form A, B, C, D, E, F is one group, and then contained in it is the things of the form 1, 1, 1, D, E, F. Okay, and the claim is that this is a normal subgroup. And is it clear that you could check that? All right, so you have to multiply A, B, C, D, E, F, 1, 1, 1, D tilde, E tilde, F tilde with the inverse. And see that this is of the form 1, 1, 1, D double tilde, E double tilde, F double tilde.
Okay.
Right, so it's a normal subgroup, and so then you end up with something that's abelian. All right, and so then the claim is that this thing then has its own normal subgroup, and what's that? So so inside of here is a normal subgroup, which is 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, F. Okay, so that gives you another normal subgroup. And once again, the quotient is going to be abelian. So this time it's going to be two-dimensional. And then finally, I'll just put the trivial group. And then this group itself is abelian. Okay, so you get a series of length three. The quotients are all abelian. And they exist because they're normal subgroups. Okay, so that's how you check that it's solvable. And solvable groups are pretty much, this is what they look like. They're subgroups of these.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments about solvability? Okay, all right, very good. So then, let's see. So I found some problems that were not so much focused on any particular topic this time, but kind of scattered type problems. So let's see. So here's one. So they're just a little bit out of the blue, but they happen fairly often. So I have a couple of these, and then I have some that fit some old topics. All right, so yeah, so feel free to think about this one for a moment and indicate when you've got some ideas here.
I have not an idea, but a question.
Okay.
What are the VIs meant to be?
They are vector spaces over an infinite field.
Okay.
Are they subspaces of B?
Yes. That's correct. That's what it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's some person is ready to comment on this one.
I remember a trick for this one.
Okay.
And so like instead of considering vectors or subspaces, we can consider affine subspaces.
Affine subspaces, okay.
And yeah, I think it'll be easier. And use induction.
On the dimension?
Yeah.
Is the issue here that maybe union doesn't preserve the same vector space properties as a linear combination does?
I guess, I mean, the way that I would picture it is if I were just in, say R2, that if I take proper subspaces, they're just not going to be able to cover the whole thing. So there's always going to be little gaps. Okay, but are people managing to make this trick work?
Well, I think that the base case, it's easy.
Okay.
Because we just have like a line and a finite number of points, but our field is infinite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so to use induction, we just need to argue that there are, okay, yeah, so let's suppose that B has dimension n, and so we know that our statement is true for smaller dimensions.
Right.
So if we can write V just like in the statement,
mm-hmm.
then each VI needs to have a dimension less or equal than n minus one.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so now we can argue that there are infinitely many vector subspaces of dimension n minus one, because we can just translate them.
Okay.
That's where we are using that there are affine subspaces. Otherwise, it gets a little tricky to prove that. But I think that you also can do it, like maybe using something like Ries representation theorem or something like that.
Okay. But translation is going to work here. Okay.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So then we just take one subspace of dimension n minus one that it is not already in the union and intersect with B.
Let me call it something. W, and consider W. So this is going to be the intersection of W with V. So it's going to be the union of the VI intersect W.
Yeah, and all of those are affine subspaces as well.
Right. Okay. And so so we've reduced it by a dimension.
Yeah.
Looks good. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments about this one? All right. And what about number two? Does that one behave differently?
Yes. And I think I have an example.
Okay. All right. Let's try that.
I had three proper subgroups. The first one was Z times 2Z. And the next one was 2Z times Z. And then the last one is the subset of Z squared, where the entries are either both odd or both even.
Okay. Great. Okay, and so if we take the union of these, so this one is anything with the second entry even, this one is anything with the first entry even, and this includes everything where they are both odd. So that covers everything. Right there. Okay, any thoughts or comments about this one? All right, so I think there's one more that's a little bit, it's kind of out of left field. So, there we are. Oh, okay, sorry. I seem
what
to
is
have...
A to the A?
Yeah, yeah, sorry. I just typed these in not very accurately. So, yeah, so the, that should be
A squared.
A squared, thank you. Okay, this one person is ready to look at this one.
if you just play around with, say, AB squared, does it come out?
Yeah, I think it does. Yep. So did anyone try that? So AB squared, of course, being an element squared is identity. Oh, sorry, is AB, sorry. Okay, yeah, so actually, yeah, so did anyone get that to work?
So then BA is the identity.
Right, by canceling on both sides. So this is the identity, right?
That's a ring, that's not a field.
Yeah, how are we canceling?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, yeah, all right. So we can't cancel, sorry.
Never mind.
Right. Yeah.
My problem was easier. You should have gone along with it.
Right. Okay. But this one I agree with, the first one here.
We can prove that for every A, we have that A equals minus A.
Okay, so how do we get that? That seems like a useful lemma.
And then we can use A plus B square and use this little lemma to finish.
Oh, I see. Okay, so A plus B squared above, and then you're going to use A is equal to minus A. So this is so A plus B squared, right? So A plus B squared is equal to A plus B. And so this is A squared plus AB plus BA plus B squared. And so that's A plus AB plus BA plus B, right? And then we can subtract, and we have 0 equals AB plus BA. So, right, so AB equals minus BA, but then that's also equal to AB. Okay, like so. Okay, and how do we get this first little lemma? Is that one easy also?
Well, yeah, if the ring has an identity.
Oh, okay. And you're going to use A plus 1 squared?
Yeah.
Okay, does that make sense to everyone?
Do we know that A must have identity?
It's a fair question. It is a question of whether rings automatically have an identity, and there's some variation in choice of definitions. It would have been nice to say which one was meant here. Yeah, so so can I improve it without the identity?
I mean, I did pretty much the exact same thing.
Okay.
As what was in this first box, I considered a plus b squared.
Okay.
Minus a plus b.
Mm-hmm.
So this is zero.
Mm-hmm.
But if we expand the left-hand side, we get a squared plus ab plus ba plus b squared
mm-hmm.
minus a plus b. But a squared and b squared are really a and b.
Mm-hmm.
And so those cancel out, and what you get is ab plus ba is equal to zero.
Okay, I agree. Yes.
But you know the negative element is the same as the positive element. So that means that AB minus BA is equal to zero. Right, because we said that A equals negative A up here.
Oh, right, right. Actually, but it was the A equals negative A was where we ended up using the identity.
Oh, okay. I see what the problem is. Okay.
Right.
I guess if we check a minus b squared, that kind of gives us a is minus a. Or in this case, b is minus b, but it's the same thing.
Oh, okay, good. So all right, so if we just do a similar computation, you're saying that, well, that's
what? Yes.
Okay, yeah. So I just try it. So this is a squared minus ab minus ba. Plus b squared is equal to a minus b, and let's see, right, so this then these cancel, and I get let's see, I guess I get 2b is equal to ab plus ba, and from above we have that's equal to zero, so you've computed that 2b equals zero. Nice. Okay. All right. Exactly, yeah, Boolean rings without the identity are actually useful. Right. Okay, great. So that's pretty thorough. Any other comments or questions about this one? All right. So then I have several that touch on earlier topics. Some of them are kind of a mix and sort of use a couple different topics. This one's kind of a direct ideals problem, but we're doing ideals, so that's a good one. And since I did just type them in, I may have had typos. Please comment if something looks amiss. Okay, so does anyone have a guess for what the answer is at least? This is a yes no question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the radical ideal.
Which is a very useful object. Right. Okay. And so, did people figure out what it is? What one has to check to determine that this is indeed an ideal?
Just check that it's closed under addition, and that if you multiply any element of the radical by an element of R, that remains under radical.
Right. Okay, and are either of those easier than the other? Let me call them 1 and 2.
I guess that the second one is the easier.
Yeah, okay, so.
Since the ring is commutative.
Yeah, right. So what power are we going to need here?
Mm-hmm. N works.
Yeah, N is going to work this time, right? Okay, and for one,
let's take two elements, A and B. Oh, sorry. Amy was going to say something.
Okay, and the power, say N plus M. Okay.
I hate to be this person, but since we don't know that R has an identity necessarily, we also need to check the negatives, right?
Good question. What we're looking at here is the additive structure, right? So it should have a zero, even if it doesn't have a multiplicative unit.
Yes. I mean, then we need to check that negatives of elements in the radical ideal are also in the radical ideal.
Let's see. I mean, we certainly didn't need that, but you're saying it doesn't follow from this? Let's see. So,
right, since we don't necessarily have a negative one.
Okay. Oh, I see. Since there's no negative one here. Okay, all right. So, sure. Good. So let's do that. So, times negative one. Okay, good point. So, so then we have minus A. Okay, and what power will work there?
N again.
Almost. Oh, actually, maybe it does. Sorry, no, maybe it does. Sorry. You're right. I was just thinking that once again, you're running into the minus one problem, but you're just going to write it as minus A, right? So then we'll be there. Okay, very good. So this is in I, and you're set. Thanks. Okay, did we miss anything else?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't catch the part where we were trying to prove number one, and when we expand this equation out.
Mm-hmm.
There are some terms that looks like R plus M choose something and times mm-hmm. A times B. Oh, yeah. Where did those terms go?
Okay, so so if we expand it out precisely, then as you say, we're going to get this sum. Since it's commutative, they just bunch up into this N plus M choose R, A to the R, B to the N plus M minus R, like so. And so this is for R equals 0 to N plus M. And we'll split this into two parts where R is less than or equal to N and where it's bigger than N. Okay, and so this will be, for the first one, we pull out the A to the N.
Sorry, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. N plus N to N plus N. Right. So should I write more of this? Is clear now?
Yeah, that's a very smart way to do this. Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Other comments? Your connection failed. So what was the question? Oh, yeah, so there was the issue of whether negative A was accounted for in our previous discussion. So whether we actually got the full abelian subgroup or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, thank
that, you. Yeah, so that got fixed. Okay, any other comments or questions about this one? Okay. So let's try another. All right, so we've also been looking at these rings. Okay, and so this is an example of that. And I think I only see one typo, and it's pretty obvious. So.
And also, I guess that is the ring of our Zn, because there something weird it's written, I think.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I didn't even see that. It was clearing me in the face. Thank you, right? So this should be an X. Or the X should be an N in any case, right? Okay, are people getting anywhere? Is it clear what to do for this one?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward, checking the cases and just using that we can first do the quotient by Z and then by the polynomial.
Right, that makes sense. Does everyone agree with that?
If C is one, you get everything, right? So then it just becomes trivially, yeah.
Right, which is, I think, there's a good question whether that constitutes a domain.
It's a domain, or yeah.
It's clearly not a field. You do have to have a one in a field, and I think you need a one in a domain too. I mean, I'm not sure that's a domain either. Anyway.
Okay. Well, R0 also is.
Ooh, R0.
Is a domain, isn't it? And that's allowed.
Yeah, it is allowed. I'm not sure it should have been allowed, but it is allowed. So R0. Okay. Okay. Did people figure out what a couple of the other ones are? So is R2, so maybe this is our domain, so then we're looking for a field, so is R2 a field? Or a domain for that matter? That one clear what happened to our polynomial x squared minus 2 when we're in the field F2?
It's just x squared.
Yeah. And so that one has, is an example we already used, right? So X is a zero divisor. So this is, and R3. So minus 2, but that's the same as plus 1, I guess. Again, it's just quadratic, right? So we just have to check whether minus 1 is a square, whether 2 is a square, and it's not, right? So then, okay. All right, any other thoughts or comments about this one? All right, so that's straightforward. So here's one that mixes representations with various field extensions. All right, someone has thoughts about this one. All right, people ready to talk about this one? Okay.
Well, So I guess that since we are talking about characters, we can assume that G is finite and that the vector space is finitely dimensional, right?
Sure. Although I'm not sure finiteness of G will matter, but let's take a finite dimensional vector space. Okay.
Yeah, so we can consider about a basis for V.
Okay, so a basis for V over, let's give this thing a name, over F.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, with basis. Okay.
Yeah, and then we can prove that if we take, let's say that that's V, like that basis is V.
Oh, okay.
So if we consider B union the B moved by square root of 2.
Okay, wait, sorry. Something weird about my sound. All right, sorry. So I couldn't quite tell what you said there. So what did we do with the square root of 2?
We can consider first all the elements of B.
Okay. Oh, I see. I got it. So we have this sequence now of the elements of our original basis.
Yeah, and then we act with square root of 2 in each of them.
Okay.
And so I think that should be a basis as a Q vector space.
That sounds correct to me. Right, this is a quadratic extension, so it's a two-dimensional vector space over Q. Mm-hmm. Good. So that's good. So now we have both this. And how do we think of a character in terms of this basis now?
Well, for each G, small g in G, we can consider the matrix that represents the transformation.
Okay.
And so we know that the character, we can see how much each element of the basis is adding to the character evaluated in that element of G.
Okay. Right. I see. So chi of G will be this, you can express it as a sum of the coefficient of VI in rho of G applied to VI.
Yeah. And so we just need to check what happens with the new basis that we have.
Okay. Okay, and can we see what happens to our matrix? So we used to have this n by n matrix, and the entries, of course, were in F, and this one with entries in Q. Okay, so so can you identify then what's going to happen to the matrix? Please, I'm just writing to kill time. So this is a typical element, right? It's going to will be what row G might look like, right? It's going to be an n by n matrix with entries in F, and so the entries will be things that look like A plus B root 2, etc. Okay, and now we want to get a twice as big a matrix.
Well, it's going to be a 4x4 matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first column,
mm-hmm.
I think that we are going to have something like A, E, D, F.
Mm-hmm. Right, so it's going to have this block form, I guess, right? So these four 2x2 matrices. Right. Oh, sorry, you have a different basis.
Yeah, I think so.
How about if we reorder your basis? So we write it as V1 root 2 V1, V2 root 2 V2. That order.
Well, then the first square is going to be A, and under A it's going to be B.
Oh, under B, A, right, like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have two times A,
Okay, so let me see. See if I'm getting this right. So we're going to plug in a if we plug in a one, we should get one plus root two, and if we plug in a root two, we should get two b. Okay. All right. And then the last one.
Square root of 2 times a.
I think it might be just a, so if we just try it, what should we get? So we should have something that takes the matrix. Yeah, so, yeah, right.
And I think that makes sense with my calculations because the character was 2 times the, let's say, the rational part.
That's right, answer, yeah. Yeah, okay, that's right. So, and also these things, there better not be any, root 2 is here, right? These should just be in Q. Right. Okay, so that makes sense. So so that's what's happening to the entries. Each of these entries is giving us a 2x2 block. Okay, so then does that enable us to figure out the answer here? So chi q of g. So it's going to be the trace, right?
So I think that that's 2 times the rational part of the other character.
Okay. Looks good. Okay, any questions about that? So that's sort of playing around with both extension fields and group representations at once. Okay. All right, so trying to. Okay, this is another it's an infinite group problem, reminiscent of the problem we had about automorphisms of finite groups. All right. Anyone else getting some ideas on this one? Okay, about one more minute, and then we'll see what thoughts people have. All right, let's see. So so any thoughts? So let's see, infinite to simple group and conjugates both come up. All right, so so what are people's thoughts? So how do we make use of the fact that it's simple?
When you conjugate, should you not expect to get back yourself? Or that's still possible even in a simple group?
Well, so so let's see. So the setup we have is we have our group G, which is simple, and then inside of it we have some proper subgroup. And the conjugation is going to be, you're going to take some element of a little...
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I was thinking of this wrong. I was thinking of the Celo type of theorem.
Okay. Right. Now this is the action that they're talking about. Like that.
Well, I mean, you're kind of right in that you shouldn't always get back yourself when you conjugate. But I don't know if that helps at all.
Right. In fact, here we're saying that you should somehow often not, right? Because you're supposed to get infinitely many different things by conjugating. Right. But, okay. So did someone see how the fact that it's simple could be helpful here?
We can assume by contradiction that we have a proper normal subgroup.
Yeah, right. Since it's simple, there are no proper normal subgroups. So simple, no proper normal subgroups. Okay, and of course, proper normal subgroups are not proper, are related to maps, right? So, what's the way to say that in terms of maps from our group G?
Uh, that there are no kernels.
Right. So no non-trivial maps to other groups. Onto other groups, that means they either have to be the identity or zero. One, trivial. Right.
Sorry, how does that follow?
So these are the equivalent statements because if you have a normal subgroup N, then that gives you a map to the quotient group. And if you have a map from a group onto some group, a Q, then it has a kernel, which is a normal subgroup. So this is the bijection.
Oh, I see. Oh, that says onto. Yes, yep. Okay.
But you can drop onto if you wish, right? And just say that there are no maps because you can just consider the image. So if it's more convenient, you can just say two other groups. By non-trivial, you mean either injective or trivial. That's the same statement because you can just replace the group with the image.
So if we have a subgroup, then G should induce a permutation of that group's conjugates.
Exactly. And so what map is that giving us?
G into some symmetric group, but if that symmetric group is finite, or the image of this map is finite, then we have our contradiction. And exactly. So this must be an infinite symmetric group.
That's right. So exactly. So that's right. So this is one of the very useful actions that we talked about before were for finite groups, but it works just as well for infinite groups, right? So this is this conjugation action, and right, since G is infinite, either this is a trivial or the target here is infinite. Okay. Let me call this map. Phi sub h. So either phi sub h is trivial, or h has infinitely many conjugates. Okay, and how do we eliminate that first case?
Well, if that map is trivial, then H must be normal,
right,
in G. Does proper imply non-trivial?
Yeah. It does. Yeah. Okay, so we can eliminate this first case. So then we have infinitely many conjugates as per the goal. Okay, and is it clear why this implies the second sentence? So how do we get the automorphisms of a group?
Is it correct if I say that every element in G can act on G by conjugation?
Yes, and that's correct.
Mm-hmm. That gives an automorphism from G to G. And
correct. So that gives us a map, and now we'll be done if we can say that the image of this map is infinite, right? And can we say that from what we have so far?
Well, if we consider the kernel of this map here, that again, since G is simple, must be the whole G or trivial.
That's a good point.
And it certainly can't be the whole G by the first part.
Okay, that's right. Okay, yeah, and so C is injective or trivial? Exactly, and it's not trivial because we found some element that moves H, and so it is not acting trivially. Nice. So I noticed that your solution to the second sentence didn't even bother to use the first one. You just proved it. It would have been sufficient to just say that you only needed that there was more than one conjugate, not that there were infinitely many, and you got your result. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this one?
Sorry, I have two questions. So first, I don't understand the last sentence. So we're trying to prove the last sentence. And what happens if the kernel is everything, like the map is...
Trivial?
Trivial, yeah.
Yeah, so if the kernel is everything, so there are two cases, right? Either the kernel is nothing, in which case it's injective and we're done, or the kernel is everything. Right. So you're looking at the case where it's everything. So if the kernel is everything, then it's trivial here. You have the trivial map. And what does that mean? So that means that every element of G acts trivially by conjugation. Right. So in particular, that means that it's going to take every element back to itself, and in particular, every subgroup back to itself. So it means it's going to take H to itself under conjugation, right? So if it's trivial, if C of G is trivial, is the identity, let me say, then when I apply this conjugation to H, in fact, pointwise is going to be the same, and in particular, it's going to be the same group. But we just argued that for some elements, that's not true. But by above, for some G, this is false. So G inverse is different from H. That's the argument. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess we could also do this a different way, like more using more of the first part, in that the infinitely many conjugates means that infinitely many of these conjugation automorphisms are different from each other.
That's right. In fact, I would guess that the author of this problem had exactly that argument in mind. Yes, and you are correct. That would that's probably what they meant you to do. But this other argument seems to work and didn't need it. Right. Yes. So there are two approaches. Okay. Did that make sense, everyone? Any other thoughts or comments? Okay, let's see, we have just under 10 minutes, so I guess we have time to look at one more here. Okay, so it's another field theory one. Okay, yeah, we don't have a huge amount of time, so maybe we should just start. So there are kind of two things. You want to show that there aren't very many, and you want to find all of them. So what did people think of here?
So this homomorphism has to fix the prime subfield of C, which is Q.
Yes, that's one key observation. So a Q must be fixed.
So Q is a, three-dimensional vector space over,
let me call it F, so it has a name. Yeah, okay, right.
F is a three-dimensional vector space over Q.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can think about where the basis vectors get mapped. So yes. One has to get mapped to one. And then any mapping of the cube root of 2 is going to uniquely determine the mapping of the cube root of 4. So we just need to decide where this thing goes.
Correct.
This element cubed has to give us 2, which... This element cubed has to give us 2. And so I believe there are three possibilities. First, it goes to itself.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that it goes to, I'll call it eta, cube root of 2, where eta is a primitive third root of unity.
Mm-hmm.
And it can go to eta squared cube root of 2, where eta is the same primitive third root of unity.
Exactly. Right. So does that make sense, everyone? Everyone agree with that?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So, these are possibilities.
Yes.
So should we still need to prove that this actually induce a field homomorphism?
Yeah, so there are two things to do. One is to check that those induce a field homomorphism, and two is to show that there is nothing else. And so one of those was kind of covered by this assertion, which one I guess would say it is a lemma, that the prime subfield has to be mapped identically to itself. You could also prove that, it's not so hard. The second would be to show that these are field homomorphisms. So does anyone have an approach to showing that? Are there any tricks to showing that?
I have a trick, but I don't love it, I think. So we can use that, for example, when we have alpha and it's minimal polynomial, then the extension of alpha give us is isomorphic to.
So you're going to extend the minimal polynomial to its spreading field.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's going to be a degree 2 extension of f, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and why is that helpful, having that Galois field there?
Because we need that the Galois group acts transitively on the roots.
That's right. So we have an automorphism of this field that takes this cube root of order 3. So x is. Yeah, let me call this something. Okay. Right. Okay, and why is that helpful? Does that make sense? So if you had one map now of this K into C, then you could apply this automorphism, and that would give you the three different maps that you just listed of F into C, right? Because you have F embeds in three ways into K, which you can see by the automorphisms of K. And then that, so then you've reduced the problem to showing that there's a map from K into C. I mean, we basically wrote K as a subfield of C, so that's kind of straightforward now.
Yeah, so I guess that one's just inclusion.
Yeah, that's right. So that inclusion is a map. That's right. So that's certainly one way, very clean way to approach checking that those are different. I mean, it's also, you could also do it more directly, but yeah. And that certainly is a good way to do it. Okay, we get out of time, and let's see. So what I was thinking to do next time is to go back and look over the same exams that we did before, maybe another one too, this time see if the problems are now ones that we can do, and just use those as the problems to look at. Of course, there are a lot of problems on those, so we will have to just choose the ones that seem of particular interest. So you might want to just look over the whole exams that are on the web page that we've looked at so far, and see if there are any particular problems of interest. My thought is to just kind of go through those and focus on any problems that are interesting, and otherwise just kind of rush through them, indicating ideas of how we would approach each one. Okay. All right, then I guess I will see everyone tomorrow.